The following introduction should be sung to the tune of My Favorite Things. I'm just going to recite. Golden fried chicken and a large three-bean salad, coleslaw and cornbread inspired this ballad. Bright lime green jello leaves folks wonder struck. These are the things of a classic potluck. Still, potlucks can be anything but lucky, so we brought in a man with some sure-fire recipes. Chris Kimball is host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. He came to our studios here at NPR West with dishes from his new book, Cook's Country Best Potluck Recipes. Good morning, Chris. Quite a spread.
I am bringing you a potluck supper, except that we cooked all the food. It was one person doing the cooking.
In the spirit of potlucks, though, we reached out to lots of other people, Morning Edition listeners via Facebook, and asked them to share their favorite potluck stories.
Sarah, I'm from South Florida, and I work at the University of Florida. We encourage our foreign students to bring a dish from their country. We've had some good, some bad, and some just plain weird. The chicken feet stick out the most with me.
Chicken feet, right. How about some eggs instead? Chris Kimball says nothing says potluck like deviled eggs.
Deviled eggs, the word devil goes back to the 18th century, and it meant hot or spicy, because I guess hell is hot. But the funny part is, in a church, they wouldn't call them deviled eggs. They call them dressed eggs because they didn't want to use the word devil.
This recipe for deviled eggs includes sour cream, mayonnaise, vinegar, spicy brown mustard, and this tip for hard boiling the eggs.
We found that if you put the raw eggs in cold water, bring it up to a boil, put the top on, let it sit 10 minutes. Take it out and put it in ice water immediately. It works every time, so that's great. And you don't get that greenish tinge.
Before we dig in, a little history. The potluck dinner actually goes back to Elizabethan times.
People cooked over a hearth, and they had a big cast iron pot, and whatever they happened to have in it at the time, if an unannounced guest showed up, you get the luck of the pot.
One thing I love is a New York Times article from the late 1800s reporting on the news, the social news, society news of a potluck dinner. It seemed quite high class.
In that particular story, they sort of claimed to invent the potluck supper, but instead of bringing over a 24-hour salad or some little fried chicken, they were doing some serious cooking, some of it French. And then, of course, America's the great, you know, leveler. And so by 1900, both picnics and potlucks became sort of for the common man, not just for the rich and famous.
This is Monica in San Francisco. My family has an annual pork fest where everyone brings their favorite pork dish to share. One year, we got almost entirely dishes with bacon, and that was the year we discovered it's possible to have a bacon hangover.
Our pork dish is Lexington pulled pork. Chris Kimball says a lot of pulled pork recipes have one thing in common. They require hours of tedious grilling. His method is a lot easier.
You take pork butt, which is the shoulder cut, just go back a second into history. Butt referred to a barrel, which they store pork in. And the expression, scraping the bottom of the barrel, that comes from the pork barrel. So in the basement, you keep salted pork, and that's what you ate all winter. And by spring, you'd scrape the bottom of the barrel. So this is what people did with the shoulder cut. They barbecued it. We do it 2 hours on a grill, and then we put it in an oven for 2 hours, a low oven, and wrap it up. And the secret to this is always cook the pork to almost 200 degrees. So it's very convenient to do.
This is Adam Pratt in Smolin, Kansas. My parents used to have a church potluck called Soup Slop Soda Slurp. Everyone bought one can of soup and one can of soda, and they were all opened and mixed together in one big pot of soup and one big cooler of pop.
A slightly more elegant but still strange-sounding dish is maple sausage and waffle casserole. It's a spin on a breakfast casserole known as strata,
which is eggs, creamer, milk, and bread. So we did a version of this, which used frozen waffles, and then we have breakfast sausage, and it used eggs, of course, and milk.
As you were speaking, I've cut a square out, and I've got it on the plate, and I have to say that I was pretty leery of the idea of syrup mixed in with the eggs,
syrup, yeah.
Everything all mixed together. But this is delicious. I'm not sure on any given day in my house I would want to wake up and eat this.
This is not every day.
Feels like, first of all, I would have a heart attack. Right. That's right off. But that you would allow yourself the pleasure of it at a potluck.
It's a potluck.
Our final recipe is a dessert whose name evokes the spirit of a summer potluck, the Lazy Daisy Cake.
In the Depression, you had very few ingredients available. So what they'd like to do is create very different flavors using simple ingredients. Mm-hmm. So you take sugar or brown sugar, and this is a cake where you broil the top. And that essentially caramelizes the sugar. So you get a very different flavor from the sugar than if you hadn't done that. It's also called a hot milk cake. When you add the milk, it's hot milk. But what it does, it gives you a very soft crumb, tender crumb. It's sort of like what you expect from Entenmann's coffee cake. It's that kind of very soft, tender cake.
Why does hot milk make cake soft rather than cold milk?
I have absolutely no idea. You finally asked me a question I can't answer. It must have to do with the gluten in the flour. I'm sort of half making this up. I'm not quite sure why it works, but I'm glad it does.
Hi, this is Jonathan West. I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. One summer, I was invited to a no olive oil potluck. Each guest prepared a dish using absolutely no olive oil. The potluck was dreamy, resembling a 1950s trailer park gathering, including Jell-O and things made with Wonder Bread. It was a sterling moment full of pleasure and guilt.
Thanks to all of you who shared your potluck stories on our Facebook page. You'll find recipes at NPR.org. And thanks to Chris Kimball, whose new book is Cook's Country Best Potluck Recipes. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. In your health today, milk and honey. We look at why some folks are convinced that raw milk is better than pasteurized. First, though, a resurgence in backyard beekeeping. It's teaching urbanites about the huge role bees play in sustaining our nation's food supply. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Just outside Cleveland, in the town of Medina, Ohio, there's been a big shift in who's signing up for beekeeping classes. There were twice as many students this year compared to last. And who are these new beekeepers? Well, lots of them are women.
The surge has really been with younger urban women. And 20 years ago, nobody would have guessed that.
Kim Flottam has been teaching beekeeping for years, and he says this seems to be the trend. Nationwide, there are roughly 100,000 backyard beekeepers. Subscriptions to the publication Bee Culture are on the rise. And when he published a how-to book aimed at making beekeeping easier with more lightweight equipment, 60,000 people snapped up copies.
I know how I feel when I take my honey out of my beehives. I feel really excited. I mean, I tell everybody. I post it on my Facebook.
Jen Sass is one of these women at the top of the new beekeeping bell curve. As she walks me out to her two hives that sit along the fence of her small backyard just outside Washington, D.C., I ask her why she thinks people are so gaga for bees.
I think there's a real sort of revival of an interest in rural type things. I think also it's something...
Even if there are urban horns in the background.
Yeah, we're very urban here.
And also very into the local food movement. So even if space is at a premium, the beauty of bees is that they can pollinate flowers and plants in yards all over her neighborhood. As she lifts off the cover of one of her hives, she says she loves to watch the bees at work.
What I'm trying to discover is how productive my bees have been.
Looks like there's plenty of honey, so that's good. But there's also a bunch of bees loafing at the bottom of the hive. These are the male bees, the drones. Their sole purpose is to fertilize the queen, and now that they've done it, they're just hanging out. So the queen is about ready to kick them out. She gives this job to her female worker bees.
They kind of peck and bother them and kind of chase them out, unfortunately. It's a cold winter if you're a drone.
It's really cutthroat, the hive. If you're a slacker, you're out. And this has served the honeybee species well over the millennia. But Sass says there's a big problem for bees these days. despite all the urban enthusiasm, turns out that honeybee populations are way down. There's a syndrome called colony collapse disorder, where whole hives suddenly perish.
We've lost 40% of our bee colonies in the last 10 years, so it's really a mystery what's happening.
Now, if the only thing bees did was to make honey, maybe this wouldn't be a big deal. But bees are hugely important to our food supply. Jen Sass, who also happens to be a scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, explains bees pollinate billions of dollars worth of fruits and vegetables every year. And I'm willing to bet any of you out there listening now that before this day is over, you'll have eaten something, maybe an apple, a cucumber, some blueberries or almonds, that could not have been grown without the bees. So how does this all work? Well, let me introduce you to commercial beekeeper Dave Hackenberg. He drives his beehives all over the country, from cranberry bogs in New England to almond groves in California, so they can pollinate these crops. We reached him in his truck en route to another delivery.
We're actually in Tamaqua, Pennsylvania. Just got done delivering bees to pumpkins.
Yep, he said pumpkins. Now, no one's thinking about jack-o'-lanterns or pumpkin pie in July, but this is prime growing season, and without bees in the field to pollinate, the pumpkins just wouldn't grow right. They'd be lopsided or really small, and the farmer wouldn't get enough pumpkins to make it worth his time. So you can see why farmers need bees. But Dave Hackenberg says it's getting tougher for commercial beekeepers like him to make a good living. He's lost a bunch of hives to this colony collapse phenomenon.
When you're losing thousands of them and you got to replace them on a yearly basis, then you're probably going to go out of business.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is trying to prevent this. They're handing out some $6 million in emergency assistance this summer to beekeepers who've lost their hives. And meanwhile, scientists are still trying to figure out what's causing bee colony collapse. The latest thinking is that some combination of viruses, mites, pesticides, and climate change may be weakening the immune system of bees. For now, there's plenty of honey to go around, thanks in part to the enthusiasm of urban pioneers like Jen Sass.
For sure there is a food revolution, and the revolution is to stay local and be more excited about, you know, what you can put on the table from, you know, within 50 feet of your house.
And if you've ever wondered whether the liquid gold really has healing powers, well, you can find out the answer in my web show, Tiny Desk Kitchen, on NPR.org. I'm Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
A few months ago, we spoke to an author who wrote a book about how the British stole Chinese tea. They planted it in India and turned tea making into a massive global industry. Well, the Germans, the Belgians, the Czechs, all great brewmasters, may owe a debt to the Chinese as well. Because 9,000 years ago, the Chinese were making beer. Now, there's some debate over who invented beer, but there's no doubt that the Chinese stuff is among the oldest. And a brewery in Delaware called Dogfish Head worked with an archaeologist to decode that recipe. The result is a beer called Chateau Jiahu. We sent our producer Brad Horn to find out how they did it.
Chateau Jiahu is a time capsule from 7000 BC. But to hear Dogfish Head owner Sam Calagione talk about what beer was actually like back then, it's not really the kind of thing that makes you say, hey, pass me another ice-cold ancient ale.
Probably all beer thousands of years ago to our modern palates would have tasted spoiled. In fact, people would drink it out of a straw, and that's because they were trying to avoid the chunks of solids and wild yeast and stuff that was in it.
So how do you go from chunks of wild yeast to a beer that you can get at your local store? You don't start with Sam Calagione or Dogfish Head Brewery. You start with Dr. Patrick McGovern.
I'm the scientific director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Laboratory at the University of Pennsylvania Museum.
Who, like he said, is a biomolecular archaeologist. He studies fermented beverages, in other words, booze, by analyzing the pots that held the drinks thousands of years ago.
So we use techniques like infrared spectrometry, mass spectrometry, and so forth.
Dr. McGovern helps Dogfish Head revive long-dead brews using modern tools to figure out what used to be in the ancient pottery he comes across. About 10 years ago, he set out to find some of this primordial crockery on a trip to China.
Well, I went to a town called Zhengzhou, where they had all the pottery collected from this early Neolithic site.
Which translates to pottery that's about 9,000 years old, and it was found in a burial ground next to 9,000-year-old skeletons. The Neolithic period started about 12,000 years ago, and is thought to be when humans started doing things like settling down, raising crops, and apparently getting a little tipsy. Dr. McGovern thinks that when humans stayed in one place long enough, they were able to discover the process of fermentation that led to the world's first alcohol. The Chinese archaeologists allowed Dr. McGovern to bring the ancient pots back to Philadelphia with him.
And then we began doing our analyses,
where he uncovered molecular evidence that the vessels contained an alcoholic beverage made of rice, grapes, hawthorn berries, honey, and chrysanthemum flowers.
What we found was something that was turning up all over the world from these very early periods, is that we don't have just a wine or a beer or a mead, but we have like a combination of all three.
And this is where Dogfish Head comes in. Dogfish owns a tiny but respected sliver of the U.S. beer market, just 1/20th of 1%, according to Caligione. And they've earned that sliver by being risk takers. Dogfish has produced other ancient brews with Dr. McGovern, like their Midas Touch beer, which is based on molecular analysis of pottery found in what is claimed to be King Midas's 2,700-year-old tomb. But like Caligione says, Jiahu is different.
It's the oldest known fermented recipe in the history of mankind.
So Caligione and Dogfish brewers set out to recreate what might just be the world's first alcoholic beverage. The biggest difference between what Neolithic humans probably drank and what you can buy today is that Jiahu contains barley malt, which makes it more commercially viable, less grog-like, more beer-like. At the Dogfish Brewery, surrounded by giant tanks of beer, Caligione and brewer Brian Selder are making Jiahu by pouring bucketfuls of fermentables into a shiny 10,000-gallon tank.
It's rice and malt. Makes
rice,
up this meat.
Malt, honey, grapes, hawthorn fruit.
Correct.
Which is brought to a boil and then left to ferment for a month. This year, Dogfish Head will brew about 3,000 cases of Jiahu, a small batch by commercial brewing standards. At $13 for a wine-sized bottle, Jiahu is about 6 times the cost of Budweiser. But Caligione is actually seeing sales of Jiahu and his other specialty brews increase during the recession.
In this economy, a person probably can't treat themselves, the average person, to a new SUV or a new vacation home, but they can surely afford to trade up to world-class beer.
Jiahu isn't cheap, especially for a beer, but it's a lot cheaper than a plane ticket to Neolithic China. Brad Horn, NPR News.
Okay, I'm in the studio. I've got a tall amber bottle of Jiahu beer right in front of me. Brad Horn is next to me. You're back from your hardship assignment tasting beer, Brad, and I hope you got some additional combat pay for all the danger you faced.
Yeah, I'm in discussions with accounting about that.
Okay, good. All right, so you got two frosty glasses here. Shall I do the honors?
Yeah, go for it.
While I'm pouring, Brad, tell me what I should expect to taste.
Well, if you were having this like 9,000 years ago when this was brewed back in China, it would have been something like a groggy mix of grape wine and honey. But they don't think that would really appeal to a modern-day beer drinker. Mm. So they changed the recipe. And basically, you should taste a really sweet beer with hints of grape and hawthorn fruit and honey.
And what's hawthorn fruit again?
It's a berry from the hawthorn tree that's pretty common in Western Asia.
I got it. Okay. Shall we try it?
Yeah.
Okay, here it goes. As they say, not bad. Not bad. I do. It's very fruity.
Mm-hmm.
Grapey, honey.
Yeah, tastes a little bit like a wine beer.
Yeah, like an alcoholic cream soda.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
Yeah, I like it too.
That's producer Brad Horn, sometimes known as our chief very special senior international beer correspondent. Brad, thanks so much.
Sure. Thank you, Guy.
And if you'd like to see photographs of the Dogfish Head Brewery making this year's batch of Chateau Jiahu, head to npr.org.
The massive oil spill is taking a toll on the people who live and work along the Gulf Coast. Mike Voisin and his family have an oyster business in Houma, Louisiana. He's also the past president of National Fisheries Institute.
There are some challenges, and I'm hoping, you know, last week we had some openings of recreational fishing here in Louisiana. About 86% of Louisiana opened up. We're hoping soon we can get the commercial areas opened up as well, and We still have about 50% of the commercial operations open. So with that, we still produce a lot of seafood products down here, and people need to be aware of that, and they need to know that it's being tested.
That testing is being carried out by the U.S. government. Three federal agencies are working to make sure seafood coming from the Gulf Coast waters is safe. Teams of sniffers have been trained to root out tainted seafood and to help determine when waters close to fishing can be reopened. NPR's Kathy Lohr has more.
John Stein is head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's inspection program. He says with all the technology available, one of the most effective tools for sensing tainted seafood is still your nose.
And if you think about your ability to detect something in your refrigerator, it has an off odor, you can detect at very, very low levels.
State employees and professors, 56 of them who live along the Gulf Coast, have been called into sniffing duty. The FDA and NOAA conduct training for these people who are the first line of defense.
I'm Lucina Lampilla. I'm an associate professor with Louisiana State University. We are in a food processing lab here in the food science building.
Lampilla is one of the local sniffers, and she set up a test for us. Covered glass casseroles sit on a table. Some contain corn, cucumbers, and watermelon. These are just cleansing agents. Others hold raw shrimp. We open a lid and take what Lampilla describes as small bunny sniffs.
Really fresh seafood, the typical consumer shouldn't be able to smell much of anything.
But when we test a bowl of shrimp that Lampilla tainted with a small amount of ammonia, it's pungent and putrid.
It smells bad, and it's decomposition aroma of that. Ooh, I didn't want to use the actual oil with some of the volatile hydrocarbons that are in there for safety purposes.
These screeners don't have to determine what type of contamination is in the samples, whether that's oil, dispersant, or something else. They only detect whether a sample is normal by testing it against a baseline of seafood caught before the spill.
Believe me, I don't believe someone would go ahead and attempt to eat something that is tainted because it is very aromatic and it's quite unpleasant.
Here's how the testing process works. Seafood samples are collected from the boundaries of areas where fishing is closed. The newly trained sniffers take a whiff. And if the seafood passes muster, it goes to a panel of seven expert inspectors in Pascagoula, Mississippi. The experts can detect a tiny bit of contamination, one part per million. Newer state screeners, up to 10 parts per million. That's a single drop in a gallon of water. Steve Wilson is NOAA's chief quality officer. He participated in the training.
You have known experts who are in the room who, in fact, can help direct the trainees towards this is the sort of smell you should be getting. You might get it in your tongue. You might get it in the back of your nasal cavity. You might feel it right here.
NOAA officials are on high alert to prevent any seafood containing oil from being caught and sold. In addition to using sniffers, the agency sends hundreds of samples to a lab in Seattle for chemical analysis. So far, just one sample came back tainted. NOAA's Steve Wilson.
Even though it may be safe to consume, if you smell oil, people won't want to buy fish, and so the market gets depressed as well.
One of the largest markets in Louisiana is Tony's Seafood in Baton Rouge, where Bill Pizzolatto is one of the owners.
We just have an assortment of different kinds of fish, catfish, freshwater, buffalo and goo, different varieties of fish, farm-raised fish, redfish out of Texas. Then we have shrimp.
Blue crabs and crawfish are big right now, coming in fresh daily, where they're inspected and sorted on a conveyor belt. Pizzolatto says he now has lots of frozen seafood on hand, fish caught in the months before the spill. His father started this market 50 years ago, and he says he knows the locals here who have continually monitored the spill and the areas open for fishing.
We try to be sure that our seafood is safe and knowing the source where it comes from, and just try to just take it and hopefully we can get through all this and get by.
People in Louisiana and along the Gulf are still buying and eating seafood. The problem is, with so much oil in the water, many across the country are wary of fish caught here. But NOAA officials say the seafood that gets to market is safe. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.